Hello, it is September 16th, not 15th. We are recording on a Sunday afternoon, and this is The Right Side with Andrea, and as always, my co-host, Kim. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Andrea. How are you today?
I'm great. So we are honored to have a fellow, like, 35, 36-year-old with us. Commentary's Noah Rothman is here. How are you, Noah?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for having me. 36.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, I have come to realize that while we're all within, because I didn't realize that I thought we were all like 1982 kids, but because we were all kind of graduated within around the 9/11, you know, thing, like we were all kind of going into college, if not in college, and kind of that whole range. And so when you said you made a comment about being almost 40, and I was like, excuse you. But I will say that.
Yeah. So my philosophy is that the day you turn 35, you are almost 40. You're on the true. Other side of 35. You're closer to 40 than you're not.
Well,
and then if you fill out paperwork, it's like, which range are you? Are you in the 35 to 40 range? Yes, we are.
So oh, I
we're
know.
Basically 40.
I know. Yeah. When I had
some
to
people see that as dark. I don't think that's really a terrible thing. I haven't minded getting older. Not yet, at least.
Yeah, you know,
yeah, I'd say okay.
I definitely like have enjoyed my 30s better than my 20s, and I'm hoping, like, everybody says, oh, your 40s are even better. So I'm like, I get it. I'm just like
starting to develop some professorial Mitt Romney type shocks on the sideburn area.
Oh.
And so I'm hoping that going gray conveys a little bit of credentials.
Yes, I see you're hoping for that, and here I shared publicly last week that I found my first gray hair on my temple the other day, and so my daughter is more than pleased, if not gleeful. That's from me, Mom. And then I told her I plucked it out. She goes, "You plucked out something that I gave you?" It's like, yeah. she's kind of sadistic and messed up. But anyway, so just to kind of like, we just had 9/11, and just because since we all kind of were around that age, I was telling again my 10-year-old daughter that I didn't even have a cell phone on 9/11. So I was just going to find out from each of you what pieces of technology that you remember about that day, not to kind of like joke around about like a serious matter, but just how different technology was, and that my daughter can't even like fathom. The fact that I didn't have a cell phone on 9/11 2001.
I was it was the very beginning of my sophomore year in college, and I did have a cell phone because I remember having a cell phone in high school, but it was a really rudimentary one. I mean, the kind of thing that you would get obviously in 1998. But I definitely didn't use it. I was using the college, phone, which has like a wire and a dial. You know, it was a very sort of standard landline phone and a tube television watching the events unfold. That was my technological level.
Yeah, Kim,
yeah,
what
I had the old just like a black Nokia phone that flipped down, and you had to pull the antenna up and, yeah, at the top. And it was given to me by my dad just in case of emergency, because I didn't have an actual, like, my own cell phone until after college, so a few years after that. So I just had the emergency-only phone.
Yeah, see, and I was just going into freshman year, so I think the reason I'm sure by the following year I had one, so, but yeah, it's just so crazy, like, watching the old footage and stuff like that, and people talking about how, like, look, this was, like, the cell phone technology was rudimentary compared to what we're used to now. So fast forwarding 17 years, we'll just touch on something that you happened to you. Like, I think most people know. If they don't know, you often appear on Morning Joe. And as Kim and I discussed last week with Casey Maddox, about the Kavanaugh hearings, we had another full week basically of, two different stories about Kavanaugh. First, the first half of the week was his testimony, and do you kind of want to talk a little bit about what happened? Because you got a lot of backlash actually on Twitter, which is where I actually first saw this and was like, what is he talking about? And went to go look up this clip and found it and posted on it. Do you kind of want to like talk about just how difficult kind of dealing with the media kind of putting Kavanaugh into a light that he's acting abnormally, and kind of the misinformation that's being pushed out there, and just how you can kind of push back on it if you, or your experience of, yeah, whether or not that works.
Sure. So just, you know, the Twitter feedback alone is sort of a tough gauge for me, because I honestly don't see a lot of my mentions unless I actively search for it. I don't know what happened, but at some point Twitter must have learned that I really like filtering just about everything out so that I don't interact with you. It's like a one-way conversation. But sometimes I do search my handle, and especially when I'm on television, just to see what the general reaction is, and it's almost exclusively negative all the time. But in particular, that one I knew was going to be bad because I was going up against the hosts. I mean, it seemed like the general consensus in that particular moment, including Joe and Mika and everybody else who was on set at the time, was that this particular offense was egregious. And it might not be one that's actually really generated a lot of traction out there, because there's been so much that Democrats and opponents of this nomination are just throwing at the wall, that this one kind of came and went really quickly. But it was a line of questioning from Senator Kamala Harris, who was asking Judge Kavanaugh to opine on the idea that is it constitutional for a president to be able to bar entry into the United States for a whole class of people based on race or national origin? And that is obviously the key question, the center of the question that was litigated when the president issued these three iterations of his travel ban, the first two of which did not survive scrutiny in the courts. And Judge Kavanaugh said that. And also said that he was unable to opine simply on the matter, sort of danced around it. And then Harris moved on to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was upheld in a Supreme Court ruling in 1889. And she asked again, Judge Kavanaugh, whether or not he believed that this law, which was never explicitly ruled unconstitutional, was unconstitutional. And he also danced around that question, with the exception of the fact that he said that the court rulings in this period, notably Plessy v. Ferguson, were discriminatory. Use that phrase. And the reaction from Judge Kavanaugh, sort of not being a pundit here and saying, you know, I'm not going to really opine on these things, was really over the top, in my view, and very uncharitable to Judge Kavanaugh. It was, in the eyes of his detractors, sort of a part and parcel of how corrupted Republicans have become in the age of Donald Trump, that they feel they cannot call a spade, particularly when it is nakedly racial or racist, as is the case with the Chinese Exclusion Act. And I think that's deeply unfair. Not only is Judge Kavanaugh in this case sort of abiding by the Ginsburg rule, as in Ruth Bader, not really opining on the nature of a case without having heard the arguments in that case, which seems to me best practice. But he was giving clues as to how he would feel about these sort of things by calling, for example, the discriminatory elements of this period's court's rulings discriminatory. That seems to me like it's giving you what you want. And also, you know, we shouldn't expect judges to opine on and prejudice cases that are directly before the court or may come before the court, like obviously this Chinese Exclusion Act case, which a lot of people said, you know, sort of buttressed as sort of legal theory, buttressed, the president's defender said this, buttressed the travel ban cases. So it could very well, theoretically at least, come before the Supreme Court. And then the fact that people were just dismiss that as though it was some sort of a blinkered attempt to defend what is obviously naked and racial here, was to me just ideologically silly. I am very, like, overwrought. I didn't understand where everybody was coming from with that, and it was only one element of a series of events over the course of these last 2 weeks during these hearings that have just been humiliating, that have been attacks on fundamental institutions in the Senate by Democrats, that have been innuendo and smear and just really noxious behavior and question begging, so much question begging, to the point where it's like obviously they're trying to tarnish the nominee, but in so doing they're also tarnishing the Senate itself and our governing institutions by proxy, including the Supreme Court. A lot of faith is going to be sapped in that institution as a result of this process by people who think Democrats are fighting some sort of a righteous fight. That's really irresponsible.
Yeah.
It really seems to me like the Democrats are trying to show that they're doing something and because they know pretty much they don't have a chance of stopping the nomination from going forward and him being confirmed, they really want to make it look like they're putting up a good fight, that they're, you know, they're going as far as they can to keep this horrible, evil person who's been nominated by this president that they believe to be evil, the second nominee for, you know, from this president and everything, that they're trying to make it look like they're accomplishing something and actually making progress when they're really not. And one thing I thought was funny about that clip on Morning Joe was that Joe and Mika, when Donald Trump was Donald Trump the candidate, whether they actually liked him or not, or just wanted to pit him against Hillary Clinton because they thought that she would just beat him or something, they really helped propel him to a level of prominence, you know, before the primaries and during and everything. So their insistence that, you know, Kavanaugh is this representative of this evil person that they actually helped to kind of prop up there is, I just thought was amusing. But also, I think it was Joe, maybe it was Mika too, but they kept saying that, you know, he's afraid to answer questions. Why is he afraid to answer questions? Well, like you said, all the nominees in the past, and there was a montage, I think it was on Free Beacon, but they had a montage of all these nominees saying, you know, I'm not going to, you know, share my opinion on that. It, you know, I'm invoking the Ginsburg rule and everything. It's, they've given this allowance to all these other nominees except Kavanaugh. And I don't even remember this harsh of treatment for Gorsuch. I mean, maybe I missed something, but they seem to just be pulling all the stops for Kavanaugh.
Right. But yeah, it seemed, no, yeah. Oh, I was just going to point out like that it should, Kavanaugh's major cardinal sin that is his problem, is he is Donald Trump's second Supreme Court nominee. That is it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead, Noah.
No, I agree generally with all of that. You know, I think probably one of the more revealing elements of this whole farce that has become of these hearings was really early on, very early in the process, when Cory Booker declared himself Spartacus. This is my I am Spartacus moment, he said, and then that made a lot of headlines. But what really we should have focused on was what he was doing. His intention was to violate Senate confidentiality rules. He said, I am deliberately and intentionally violating this rule knowingly, is what he said. And understanding the consequences could be and should be expulsion from the Senate. Now, it turns out that he wasn't violating confidentiality rules. The document that he wanted released had been cleared from the process already by the individual who's responsible for vetting these documents from the White House. But Cory Booker didn't accept that. He was adamant that he had broken these rules, even though nobody was contesting that any rules had been broken. He insisted frequently that he was undermining the Senate's integrity, because that was the point of it. It wasn't about transparency. His ideal was to show his constituency that he thought proceedings were so illegitimate that he had no respect for them. Sheldon Whitehouse said the same thing. Quote, I want to make it absolutely clear that I do not accept this process. Because I do not accept the legitimacy or validity, quote, of that process, then he's free to ignore the rules that have governed Senate confirmation process since, you know, time immemorial. And that's a pretty dangerous place to be. These people are savvy politicians. They know what their constituents want, and their constituents want to see the place burn. That's a dangerous thing.
And then with Kamala Harris, with her sharing of that altered video, which was pretty, well, it's very misleading, completely misleading, making it look like Kavanaugh believes that all contraception, that it's all abortion inducing. And she shared that on social media and other people picked it up and ran with it. And even when she was called out and she was, you know, told that this was not at all what actually happened, that they had taken, you know, the little phrase they said off of the video just to make him look like another opponent for women and women's rights and reproductive health care and everything. She doesn't care either. I mean, she's in the same boat as Cory Booker. They really want to make it look as if they're fighting against something. And like you said, that they don't believe in the validity of the process.
Yeah. That one's even more egregious because, I mean, it was so obvious that she was misrepresenting those remarks by cutting out the part where he explained that he's just rehashing essentially the plaintiff's case, or an amicus brief, and I'm not even sure if it one or the other, but it might just be the plaintiff's case. And if we're going to criminalize the restatement of your opponent's argument in a sympathetic fashion, because it betrays too much sympathy, I guess. We're criminalizing argumentation. It's pure performance art, and it's politics, obviously. But it is the sort that radicalizes, and I think that's everybody needs to pump the brakes a little bit. I don't know if you know me or follow my politics in the Trump era, but I haven't been especially kind towards the way in which Republicans have comported themselves, in the nature of what Donald Trump makes his supporters do for them. I think I'm in pretty good terms when I say that the comportment of Democrats in this case has been as destructive to institutions and governing norms and the American people's faith in their capacity of politics to solve their problems in their daily lives. I mean, we're doing some very real damage to the foundations of the Republic here. And I don't say that too lightly. A lot of people are very quick to say in the Trump era, you know, how egregious and authoritarian things have become, and how we're devolving from a constitutional republic into some sort of a banana republic. I think it goes a little too far, but when you see people like this taking a sledgehammer to the foundations of the Senate, yeah, it's applicable.
Yeah. So the second half of the week still had to do with Kavanaugh and this letter that Dianne Feinstein has been holding on to since July. Kim, do you want to do like kind of a little, I mean, this is, to me, even more egregious because it's just so hideously awful that they would pull this.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's just vile. Well, of course, the hearings ended, and then Dianne Feinstein comes up with this, presents this letter, not to the media or anyone else, but she presented it to the FBI so they could look into it, which they decided not to launch an investigation, but they handed it to the White House as sort of part of the background file on Kavanaugh. But the letter, as we all know by now, was talking about some behavior that Kavanaugh engaged in when he was 17 in high school, that he had held a girl down during a party with another friend, and he had tried to force himself on her, and she escaped and got away and everything. But this letter is basically talking about his sexual misconduct when he was a minor, and saying that I guess is a reason it should either be investigated or he shouldn't be confirmed, you know, onto the Supreme Court. So she, you know, gave it to the FBI. They're not doing anything with it, but it's just this, like, I think progress. I mean, of course, they've had their own issues with, you know, Kavanaugh and the truth. But people are saying, well, this is Brett Kavanaugh's Me Too moment, and we should really look into this, and this is a problem. And obviously, if there is, you know, sexual misconduct in the past that is a serious issue, then sure, we need to question, you know, the confirming someone like that to the Supreme Court. But there's also a letter that was signed by 65 women who knew Kavanaugh in high school, and maybe even a little bit beyond, but definitely in high school, you know, confirming his character and the kind of person he was. So of course, this seems like the 11th hour attempt to not just stall the nomination, but to kill it completely. And the fact that she had this letter for, I think, since July, you said, but she didn't bring it up at all during the hearings. She never brought it up at any other time. And Kavanaugh has been on the U.S. Court of Appeals for 12 years, and his process to get to his current position as judge, that took 3 years. So his background has been looked into. So many people have been talked to who knew him. And just the attempt to keep everything from moving forward, it's just disgusting. And I think even some liberals were talking about it. I think Bill Maher said that it was, you know, a horrible tactic for them to use.
I've actually been surprised by the extent to which you've seen some usually pretty partisan liberals call this what it is, which is an attempt to smear someone's character through innuendo. So what we know about this whole thing is Representative Anna Eshoo, not Dianne Feinstein necessarily, but they're all, you know, Democrats have in Congress can talk to each other, so we don't know who knew about this when, but she got this letter in July, and the letter alleges, as far as the New York Times reporting goes, and if you guys know more about this than I do at this point, you know, last I checked on this was Friday, so things might have developed. The allegation involves Brett Kavanaugh, when he was a minor, exclusively minors in this story, in high school, at a party in which alcohol was involved, is that him and a friend cornered a woman in a room, locked them in the room, And then got at some point went back into the room with the music was loud, and Brett Kavanaugh allegedly put his hand over her mouth. That was the extent of it. Now, I don't mean to, you know, undermine the seriousness of those allegations. They could be very serious, but it is not sexual assault, which, as we said, it might just be assault, but it is not sexual in nature as far as I understand it. So that being said, when they dispatched, for example, Ronan Farrow, who has a great reputation in the Me Too era for being a guy who really uncovers a lot of these pretty shady and sleazy people who have used private institutions to cover up their bad behavior for decades. Mm-hmm. He and Jane Meyer wrote a piece for the New York Times, elaborating on these allegations, and it was not Ronan Farrow's reporting. If you're familiar with how he does this sort of thing, he presents ironclad cases with multiple women demonstrating in pretty graphic detail the extent to which allegation B happened, allegation C happened. Farrow's reporting is pretty ironclad. This didn't read like Ronan Farrow's report. It read like the byline which he shared it with a woman named Jane Meyer, who's famous for devoting her entire career to uncovering the Koch brothers' conspiracy and how they have their wicked influence has managed to tilt American institutions to the right. And this piece was light on detail and heavy on Democratic talking points, to the point where it actually said that Dianne Feinstein's intention in putting this letter with redacted names and no information out into the public and to the FBI, which the FBI, as you said, summarily dismissed it, essentially, was to get Democrats back on track. Like, they really wanted to talk about legal issues and how Brett Kavanaugh would behave as a justice and not personal stuff like this. I mean, it struck me as so much damage control. Really, really hurting the reputations, I think, of every reporter whose name graced that story. And also of the Democrats who have appealed to this tactic. It has landed with a thud in the same way that the racial litmus test, the Chinese Exclusion Act thing landed with a thud. It was, very similar to a variety of other claims that, for example, Senator Harris has made. Like, she dropped this sort of innuendo-laden thing about whether or not Brett Kavanaugh had a conversation with somebody at the firm Kazowitz, Benson & Torres, which was Donald Trump's personal attorney's representatives, about the Mueller probe. And then she just kind of let that hang and said, "You're not answering my questions. There's something you don't want to tell us." And then it never came up again. Because there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. It's all about sort of just dropping these smears and letting the imaginations of the spectators go wild, reach the worst possible conclusion, and never follow up. It's just, it really is a very tired tactic and a shameful one.
So there,
I was going to say, I've actually seen a few other people discuss the quote unfitness for the position. If all this stuff is true about Kavanaugh, or even just the allegations are true. I saw Steve Deese actually talking about how this is not in any way different from the attempts to smear, quote, smear Roy Moore, which I personally did not think that Roy Moore should be in the Senate. And I know, Noah, that you were pretty insistent on the fact that he was not fit for the Senate as well. And people, Steve Deese and a few others, you know, agreeing with him, saying that this is in no way different. And if conservatives don't call Kavanaugh, you know, away from the Senate, then they're being hypocritical because of how they treated Roy Moore. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Steve Deese has a very personal relationship with Roy Moore. He likes the guy. They're friendly, mm-hmm. and that has tainted his commentary. And I've told him that to his face. We had an exchange on the fitness of Roy Moore for an appointment to the Senate well before these allegations came out. And I took a very antagonistic position, not because of anything that has to do with his personal conduct, but his view of the Constitution and his views of how he comported himself as a constitutional officer and a member of law enforcement. And it was my view that he had no respect for the Constitution and would behave in a similar fashion in the upper chamber of Congress. To the extent that, and Steve Deese took the alternate position, saying that judicial activism, essentially, when it's conservative judicial activism, is super good. I disagree. And when these allegations came out, all of them, a cascade of them, from many women who are on the record, who gave their names, dates, details, and information pertinent to the investigation to individuals like I think Ronan Farrow was a part of that, actually. I'm not sure. But many reporters were engaged in sussing out what happened and over the
multiple...
And Roy
Moore was an adult, and these were minors.
And many instances. And so the notion that there is anything sort of similar here, I mean, it serves Steve Dace, I guess, to protect his friend's reputation by suggesting that this woman who won't go on the record is one person who's... detailing in the most vaguest way possible 36-year allegation with no corroborating evidence and no one else coming forward to restate the case positively in her favor is in any way remotely similar to what Judge Moore went through. I'm sure he thinks that's a sharp political argument, but it lands rather flat when you even apply the just bare minimum level of human common sense to the sussing out the details of these allegations.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that one, definitely. And one thing I thought was interesting about
so I don't
the
look very highly,
reaction.
I suppose, on the gentleman.
No.
But we had a friendly conversation. I'll say that.
One thing I noticed about the Democrats in reaction to the 65 women who have signed this letter saying that they know the character of Kavanaugh and everything is almost the horror at the fact of, well, you need women, 65 women, to say that you're a good guy. Well, then that means you're not a good guy. I missed that part where it said a host of people saying that you're a decent person and have shown yourself to be such over the years means that you're actually not a decent person. I was pretty
right.
I don't know that argument.
I love the argument that him having all those the women that they kind of talked about on the very first or second day of the hearing where they were talking about how many
Interns. And
yes. Are they called
clerks?
Interns? Yeah. Clerks, female clerks that he's hired over the years. And kind of expounded on that. And that was that now it's a clear way that he was covering his tracks, so that he's not seen as a bad guy. My other favorite, argument or kind of like tack that people are taking is how do you get 65 women, people from high school to sign a letter? And, and someone pointed out like, well, went to a private school. These people have contacts. And I went to a very small high school. I had less than 400 people in my high school, less than 100 people in my graduating class. I could get 65 people rounded up with a few well-placed phone calls. I'm not going to say that should be applied to everyone, but I know that at least I definitely see how that could happen within about 10, 12 hours. So that was just kind of like the thing that I found was funny was just like, you guys don't know how networking works or something. So, or how
yeah,
family
and
works.
It was an unfalsifiable proposition, right? He's a bad guy because all these people were coming out in favor of him. But if they didn't come out in favor of him, that would have made him a better guy. I mean, it's obviously like an attempt to reach, for some sort of a preconceived conclusion. I couldn't do it, though. I don't think I could do it. I don't have many contacts with my high school friends, and I went to a public high school, and I knew quite – I didn't go to an all-boys guys high school, so I knew a lot of women, but I'm not sure I could pull together 65 people who I remember from back then because we just don't keep in touch. So to me, that was a pretty remarkable feat. I don't get the whole D.C. private school social networking thing. Not only do I have no interest in it, but I just completely don't understand it. Virginia Hume actually was one of the signatories of this mm-hmm. letter, and she's a pretty good writer, writes over for the Weekly Standard, and her explanation for this was pretty funny, actually. She has I won't restate it because I would do so poorly, but she has a good piece on the Weekly Standard for anybody who's interested in how this letter came together.
A question about the confirmation vote. When Scalia was when the vote went for his confirmation in the Senate, he had 98 votes to confirm. Kennedy had 97, Ginsburg had 96, and then of course, as the years have gone on, the number of confirmation yes votes have gotten lower. Alito had 58, Sotomayor had 68, Kagan 63, Gorsuch 54. So what do you think the final confirmation vote, if we ever get there, supposedly it's supposed to be at the end of September, what do you think the final vote tally will be? Do you think he's for sure going to be confirmed?
He's for sure going to be confirmed because he only needed a simple majority to confirm. And I don't know what the final total is going to be. because I'm still not 100% sure where these red state Democrats who are up next year are going to land. Joe Manchin is, and it's exclusively a political prospect. For example, if Doug Jones was up this year, he'd be voting to confirm. He's up in 2020, so he doesn't have to worry about it. It's entirely how much, how beholden you are to leadership at this point, whether or not you vote one way or the other. So Heidi Heitkamp is on the bubble. I think that's pretty much it. I mean, there's other Democrats who are up in Indiana and West Virginia and Missouri, and they're kind of on the bubble, but I just don't feel like they have anything to worry about from voting against this confirmation. It's just the nature of the environment. Democrats have so many tailwinds at this point, and they're so beholden to their base to make sure they're jazzed and energized and ready to come out to the polls, that I think they're more wary about alienating those voters than they are about ingratiating themselves with Trump voters by saying, look, I voted for this Supreme Court nominee. I don't know what kind of good faith that's going to get you or any rewards at the polls. So I don't know how that's going to turn out. It could just be, you know, the vice president could break the vote here. You might lose a Republican in this process, too. Not really sure. This last minute bombshell, this smear campaign. You know, it might shake one of these Republican senators loose who are kind of on the bubble to begin with. So I'm not going to go about predicting the final vote tallies, but it's going to be low, and it's going to be a simple majority, and that's all you're going to need, which is unfortunate because Ruth Bader Ginsburg is right when she said this week that this process has become too politicized, and it's a lot worse than it used to be. Lindsey Graham got a lot of garbage when he said, you know, when Strom Thurmond was voting to confirm Bill Clinton's nominees to the Supreme Court, he wasn't, you know, voting his convictions. He wasn't voting his ideology. He was voting more for a loyalty to institutions. And of course, you know, the professionally obtuse people who populate Twitter and whose job it is to agitate and rabble rouse said, you know, I think it was Think Progress too, said, you know, Lindsey Graham just literally said that, you know, we would be better if Strom Thurmond was around today. And that you just can't have a conversation with these people. They're not interested in a conversation. It's all bomb throwing all the time. The least charitable interpretation of everyone's remarks is the one you leap to and latch onto and render this grievous offense. It is so exhausting and so tiresome. And that's why I don't look at my mentions anymore.
So I don't mean to go off continue this topic, but I did just get an alert on my phone that says California professor, writer of confidential Brett Kavanaugh letter, speaks about her allegation of sexual assault. So that's breaking.
So it's not anonymous anymore.
Apparently not.
Well, that lends some gravitas.
Christine Blasey Ford is her name.
Okay, breaking news. The anonymity of it was a real problem for me.
Yeah.
It's still probably a problem. And I don't believe that these allegations are substantiated one way or the other. But at least she came out. I think she had to, and that's important.
Yeah. So finally, I think we can skip the Dallas police shooting because Kim, I know, wanted to talk about the Nikki Haley. We can go further into the depths of how media kind of is not doing its job, or at least doing a job, but it's not the right one. When it comes to the story of Nikki Haley and her $52,000 curtains, Kim.
How dare she? Now, the New York Times on Friday, there was a piece about, like you said, her curtains and the price of them and everything. Well, buried way down into the piece was the fact that she didn't choose these curtains. They were actually chosen during the Obama administration. Furthermore, she had no say over the curtains, you know, once she's placed into that position as ambassador. After, I guess, a few hours of people clamoring and saying that the New York Times, you know, shouldn't have said this and it was false and it was obviously misleading, they publish, an update with a title that's less clickbait worthy, I guess. And then an editor's note at the top saying, you know, that they shouldn't have said this, and it gave the impression that it was Nikki Haley. She was spending the people's money when she shouldn't have, and it was, you know, for all her, you know, down to earth, you know, attitude and everything. She's very, like, very rich and thinks she's better than everyone, you know, all this stuff. Well, that, you know, obviously is very frustrating. Some people said, well, after conservatives, you know, blew up at it, that's when they wanted to change it. But of course, the damage had been done and people had, you know, shared the story. Obviously, it's not like an end of the world sort of story, but it, you know, pushes a narrative and people believe certain things that aren't true. They don't care to read the articles, as we all have experienced before. They don't care to read the articles, so they don't really care to know the truth. They just want to, you know, pick the thing out that they would love to spread and share the most and, you know, spread that around. And it reminded me of Think Progress, which, you know, obviously they're a trash rag, but they, Ian Millhiser had a piece where he, in the headline, said that Kavanaugh said that he would kill Roe. Well, of course, Kavanaugh never said in the hearings or in other communication that they discussed during the hearings that he would kill Roe. He's obviously not going to say that. But just the idea that you can share a piece that has maybe the truth in like the middle or the bottom of the piece, or just kind of mixed throughout, you know, with your own, you know, opinion slanting it and everything, but you can have this title on an article that is false and that does not at all share the truth and spread it around just to kind of stir things up. It's just amazing to me. I mean, it shouldn't be amazing to me, but people continue to do it and others continue to read it and spread it.
Yeah, Kavanaugh said precisely the opposite in these hearings, that yeah. Roe and Casey are essentially settled. At least the precedent is settled, which is bizarre, frankly. You know, the Supreme Court has liberty to overturn whatever precedent it likes, and for to hear a conservative judge not give any credence to the central element of Rehnquist's dissent in Roe, which is that this is a broad reinterpretation of the 14th Amendment that literally has no constitutional remit, that is a pretty standard conservative line. That doesn't necessarily mean you want to see abortion outlawed, but that nevertheless Roe was a bad decision is not a controversial conservative opinion. It's rather widely held. It's controversial insofar as it's bad politics if you're trying to get confirmed to the Supreme Court and you don't want to annoy Democrats and radicalize Democrats in the streets. But I'm wondering whether or not that sort of is pointless at this point, right? Because if Democrats are going to say, even when you explicitly say I won't overturn Roe, that they can find some exigent analysis in remarks in order to define ways in which you're sneakily winking towards people and saying, well, I'm going to actually super-duper secretly overturn Roe and you're never going to see it coming, then what is the point of mollifying these people? Mm-hmm. And go ahead and say, yeah, I agree with Rehnquist. I personally don't want to see abortion made illegal, but there is no constitutionality in this. What's the difference in the reaction that you're going to have from these people? From one way or the other. I mean, you might, you're reaching a different audience with these remarks, I suppose, but that would have been a perfectly justified thing to say, I think. And it's maybe not his view, so I'm putting words into his mouth, but it is a view, and I'm not, you know, an anti-abortion fanatic. I generally do not want to see abortion made illegal everywhere. I'm not a religious conservative, I'm not a social conservative. I think that would be bad politics and bad policy. But people who say that Roe was poorly decided are correct, and there's nothing wrong with saying that.
Yeah, which is why it had to be followed up by Casey. I mean, things have moved on from there, but yeah, I mean, we've got kind of like every single one of them has said, you know, it's now precedent.
What I'm trying to say here, I guess, is that the attempt to controversialize,
right,
you know, sort of essential conservative positions here, is really going to backfire if it creates the conditions for people to say, well, you know, I'm just going to have it's the own the libs argument, right? It's the sort of like you have to be provocative now to be for provocative sake, because even the standard issue boilerplate conservatism that used to not be really all that offensive is elevated to this sort of assault on norms and decency. Mm-hmm. So why not just assault norms and decency?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. You'd rather have people out there saying what they actually think rather than skirting around and then not ever really knowing, which is why we kind of have this. Well, we are supposed to have a system where you can say what you actually think without, you know, losing your job and any type of career ever for the rest of your life.
That's also why I depart from a lot of conservatives when I 100% favor tenure for professors and even mm-hmm. you know, not high school, but definitely for professors, you need to have you need to be 100% sure that you can say whatever you want and right. offend whomever you want and not fear for your job.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
When you're in a thinking role, when your position is to think and possibly stumble onto bad ideas or controversial ideas, you need to feel safe that way.
Right, because not the reason why we have that is because of things like, you know, it's like you know, the Earth being the center of the universe used to be settled science, you know, right. a couple hundred years ago. So, well, Noah, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Appreciate
yes.
it.
And where can everybody find you? Even though you won't see their replies, even so, they can follow you, but
just the one-sided.
I'm kidding. I live on Twitter. I see almost all my mentions. So I'm joking.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can find me at commentarymagazine.com, where I write just about every day, and I tweet at Noah C. Rothman.
All right. Well, that was a great interview. More Kavanaugh stuff, but we really did. You know, I felt a little bit bad covering Kavanaugh for a second week in a row, but we really did have a new cycle of all Kavanaugh for another week.
It was a completely new week of Kavanaugh stuff, and I hope there's not another third week of Kavanaugh stuff, but I bet there probably will, because until we get to the vote, it's probably just going to be Kavanaugh yes. all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially now that, you know, with the breaking news of the writer of that letter
yes.
identifying herself, there's going to be that, you know, dropped on a Sunday afternoon. You know, Monday is going to be,
oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah. I'm so glad I don't watch cable news anymore, but the written word is probably just going to be as it, hair on fire. Anyway, so it is the After the Interview show, and we usually try to move on to lighter fare. So, lighter fare, you tried something, quote-unquote, lighter fare this week.
Oh, yeah. And of course, I like to tweet about food because people freak out. They lose their minds when you say something against a food that they love. But I tweeted, because I did try this week. I said that I tried mashed cauliflower for the first time, and I hated it. And I said, it's a no from me. And I had to, again, mute the conversation because people could not understand why I wouldn't just try to improve the mashed cauliflower by adding, here's what I had. People say to me, you needed to add more butter, you should add more salt, you should add cheese, you should add bacon, and it will improve the cauliflower, the mashed cauliflower, which is supposed to be in place of mashed potatoes. Well, the problem with mashed cauliflower is that it includes cauliflower, which I despise. And like we were saying off the air, that once you add all that stuff in there, it's not exactly healthy. And then potatoes by themselves, if you don't add a bunch of crap into it, they're pretty healthy for you.
Yeah.
But people and their anti-carb thing, I mean, I eat carbs, but I will not be introducing mashed cauliflower into my diet.
Yeah, I love all vegetables. There's really not a vegetable that I don't like. I don't really eat fruit, but I do have like some fruit aversion, specifically bananas. But yeah, I mean, I
love bananas.
I can't stand them. You will not get me to eat one. I will put them in. I love banana bread. I love banana smoothies. I will put them in. It's a texture thing, not a flavor thing.
Oh yeah.
So mm-hmm. yeah. So I actually am fine with banana flavor. I just a regular plain banana I just can't do. But I'm not you know, with all of my you know, eating disorder kind of, I never used a diet any like one, you know, I never like used a diet of any kind. I always like ended up going low carb because carbs are just naturally higher in calorie content, and that's mm-hmm. what I always did, was I always counted my calories. But this whole thing of this fad, you know, keto diet where you're supposed to be going into ketosis, which is for people that I think are diabetic or it's people who have a, like, it's same thing
it's
with
a
like
medical
the,
diet.
Yes, same thing with the gluten-free diet. That is for people who actually have celiac disease. And there has been study after study, unless you have celiac disease, there is no such thing as a wheat allergy. Now, you may be allergic to other things, like I know I know specifically that I have, when kind of like a almost like a sugar, like when I, if I have too much sugar, I start having actually like a sneeze. And that is actually, I have found out is an actual allergy that you can get, which happens like if you drink too much alcohol or something like that, it becomes sugar in your body. And then it's like I get completely stuffed up, and so that is, something that, but anyways, but I cannot stand fad diets. I under duress, my aunt had me order her from Amazon because no one else in my family apparently can order from Amazon except me. So they all asked me to order for them. I did it under duress and ordered some belly book, like some wheat belly book or something like that. And I was just like, oh my goodness, like it's $1 billion industry for a reason. People think that they're going to like lose all this weight. And yeah,
There's a certain way to lose weight. I mean, I've lost and gained and lost and gained over the years. Yes, I mean, and if I want to, I cut back on the amount of food I eat. I don't necessarily change the kind of food I eat, except, I don't sit around eating cake all day, but I definitely don't cut like carbs out completely. And I could never do the keto diet because you have to really like meat, and I really don't love meat. And so it would not be a thing for me. Plus, I have this sort of natural rebellious nature about things that like a mass of people enjoy. So when everyone starts talking about the keto diet, I'm like, well, I will specifically actively reject the keto diet because I'm going against all of you people.
Yes.
And my dad has done a low carb thing for years and years. I mean, and it works for him, but I don't know. I just don't want to eat like chunks of meat all day and mashed cauliflower and vegetables all day, even though I eat a lot of vegetables, but I just can't do the keto thing or any of the other fad diets.
Yeah. I just like, there is something I always say to people. I'm like, there is no difference between calories. Yes, there is a difference between nutrition and your calories, but there is no difference between the amount of calories, and all losing and gaining fat is calories in, calories out. And so it's like eat less, move more. I'm actually not one of the eat less people. My younger sister, and I'm sorry to every guy who's listening and is hearing two women chatting about their diets, but my younger sister is like you, just cuts back the amount of food that she eats. I actually cut out a lot of certain foods because I like to eat a lot of food. So I would rather eat a humongous salad and like no bread than like just eat a smaller amount. But that's just me. Everybody has their own thing, and you just have to figure out what's right for you. That's the and like you, I've lost at one point, I lost 138 pounds. Then I gained after my accident, gained 100 pounds, then lost 93 of it. Now I've put back on like 35 in the last 2 years, which I'm trying to lose again. And so it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, I kind of realized I'm 35. I was like, maybe this is just my life. Maybe I'm just never going to be a steady weight person. I'm just going to gain 30, 40 pounds and then lose it. And anyways, I mean, it's the struggle is real, and I feel bad.
The struggle is real.
Yeah.
So in that struggle, I'm not going to eat mashed cauliflower.
Yes.
But have you had mashed cauliflower?
I haven't had mashed cauliflower. I have had cauliflower crust for pizza. Mm-hmm. And
I've never had that.
Yeah.
Is it good?
It's decent. But I am kind of a snob about pizza crust. Like I always say, like, look, the toppings on crust, the toppings on pizza are all fairly generic, right? I mean, it's just whatever, what I always say, and I am kind of a pizza snob. The difference in a pizza is the crust, the quality of the crust. And so
I agree with you on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, I have done a lot of, again, because of the carb thing, I have done a lot of, switching out things that would normally have rice. I don't like rice anyway, but things that would normally have noodles, I have done riced cauliflower in replacement of beef with gravy, like stew beef with gravy or whatever. I'll pour that over riced cauliflower instead of having
I've done rice vegetables, but but when you tell me, not you, but other people tell me that mashed cauliflower is exactly like mashed potatoes, you are lying. Take your ketogenesis back to whence it came. It's not true.
No. So my only thing that I do not like specifically around this time of year, and I know, again, it's another thing where we're going to get a bunch of hate. I do not like any, and I know that I think you like pumpkin spice things. I do not like pumpkin spice things. I like them in pumpkin pie. and pumpkin bread. And that is the only thing that I no candles, no
See,
lattes.
I don't like pumpkin spice lattes. Oh, okay. I actually prefer flat, like the bitter plain taste of like flat white or
yes,
something.
me too.
Those are really good. I like maple candles, but I like the pumpkin-y candles or the scents. I don't really like, but I do like pumpkin pie, but we both love pumpkin pie.
Yes, I like I said on social media last week, starting when I was about 10 years old, I would only ask my mom. I did not want a birthday cake. I wanted pumpkin pie for my birthday cake.
Hey, that's I like that. That's pretty
Yeah,
unique.
well, because it's November 11th, so you're right in that like mood to, you know, start getting it's like, okay, I'm gearing up to some pumpkin pie in a couple weeks. Like, can we have it a little bit early? So, I actually quit using my grandmother who passed away in 2009. She always kept dried eucalyptus in the house, and I loved that smell. So, about 10 years ago, I completely stopped. I think I was in an apartment where you couldn't, they did not want, it was like, no, it must've been longer. It was an apartment that I was in college. They did not want you to have candles at all in the apartments because it's college kids being dumb, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. So I went to Michael's and picked up some dried eucalyptus because I knew that that always made my grandmother's house smell good. And I've used that ever since to scent my apartments or my houses or whatever that I was living in. So that's my scent is always eucalyptus in my house. So people walk in, they're always like, it smells like Michael's in here. I'm like, it's the eucalyptus.
It's a good smell.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, alrighty. Well, I think we've, fully probably alienated all sides of our listening public. Thank you so much to No Rothman. And like I meant to say at the end of the interview, if you heard Henry the Cat in the background of Kim's recording when she was on earlier, you should follow on Instagram. What is it, Kim? Henry Ross?
It's Henry Ross the Kitty. Yes, he has his own Instagram.
Yes,
following.
He's a beautiful white cat. How old is Henry?
He is about 4 and a half.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, so he's always a cute little follow. I try to fill my Instagram feed up with as much like prettiness and cuteness as possible.
Because then you can go to Twitter and experience the horribleness.
I actually realized like I posted something political on Instagram and I ended up deleting it about a day later because I was like, you know what? Politics free zone. I don't want to start in on that because I actually unfollowed a couple people that constantly put memes and stuff like that. It's like Instagram is not for posting memes. At least not my Instagram feed.
People believe your house and your lifestyle is perfect. That's what Instagram is for.
Except I will say, Bethany Mandel, I so admire her for, I mean, she just lets it all hang out like that. She fully embraces her. She's like, we are messy people. And she actually had, Lindsay Feifeld, who does another, you know, she's kind of in that kind of conservative women group, of people that kind of, anyways, she came and like, helped Bethany, organize her house. You know, she's got 3 kids under 5. Can't imagine. My mom had that too. 3 kids under 5. So anyways, it's just, I do appreciate, like, I mean, it is for like, you know, all the prettiness and loveliness, but at the same time, it's like, there are those like really honest accounts. Like same thing with like the celebrity Busy Phillips. I follow her because she's just like, it's again, she posts without makeup on and she's just kind of like whatever she's wearing. And she does have some like glam stuff that she does because she's a former model and actress, but she also has a lot of stuff where she's just in bed, you know, kind of hanging out. So it's
real life,
real life. So I've thought about trying to do that stuff, but I just like, I don't know, I'm too self-conscious, I guess. Anyway, alrighty, well, we already said where we're from, so I guess Kim, why don't you say goodbye to everybody this week?
Well, first of all, you need to subscribe. I don't know if we've said that yet. Did we say that yet?
No, because I'm bad at it.
You need to subscribe to our show. Go to therightside.us and check out our show. You can click on there to subscribe. You can also just go to iTunes and look up The Right Side with Andrea and Kim and subscribe. And, of course, leave a review for us. 5 stars is preferable after us talking about Instagram and hating keto people. We might get 4.5 stars, but that's up to you as our followers. So thank you for listening to today's show, and we will see you next time on The Right Side. Bye.